As a society, sometimes it seems like we've entered the war of the words. It's a time when we're at arms over the idea of books, of what makes a book, whether or not books still matter, and what makes the best vessel for the ideas inside. And today there are all kinds of options. There's the Kindle, iPads, computers, and good old paper. But is there a best way to read? This hour we'll be talking about what makes a book. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this morning is William Germano, author of the piece, What Are Books Good For? He teaches English at Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art. And we're happy to hear from you this morning. What do you think constitutes a book? Is a book that soft paper sound we hear when we turn a page, or is it the story inside? Call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And William Germano, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, there's a lot of debate today about books and reading, and one common lament is that the book is an endangered species. Do you agree?
Well, I think there is so much discussion as to whether books are going to exist for the next generation of readers that we lose sight of how valuable the physical book is and continues to be. I don't think books are going to disappear, but I also think there are many ways in which the book is going to transform itself. We already see it transforming itself now through electronic media, but there are, I think, pleasures and riches within the physical book that we are in danger of forgetting as we rush to the speed and easy access of digital media.
Well, you sound like one of the camp that talks about sort of the sensuous pleasure of the physical book, when the smell of the paper, the sound that the page makes when it turns, the weight of it in your hand. Do you think all of that is important?
I think it's fun. I'm not so sure that I belong to the camp of the book sensualists, but I'm sympathetic to that. I think I am susceptible to the particular appeal of old books, of books from the 17th century. I'm particularly interested in. It's such a interesting period in the history of the book and in the history of the development of ideas and culture in the West. And every book from that period is different from one another. I think we have this notion that all books in an edition are somehow identical to one another. That's a late development in books, even in printed books. The sensualist camp is very articulate in talking about the pleasures of the paper, the smell, the rustle, and so forth. They feel very much to me like excellent food writers, and I'm seduced by that language, but I try to resist it when I can.
Well, you said the physical book is important, though, so why is that?
Well, I think the physical book is important for several reasons. One, it's an extraordinary technology. It is a technology that has worked for well over 1,500 years. By the physical book, I mean the codex, the thing with pages and a cover. It's easy to use. It's extremely portable. It doesn't need batteries. You can read it in bed or in the bathtub. It's not backlit, so it's easy on your eyes, though I admit it's hard to read a physical book in a dark closet with no light. It's light. Yes, there are very big, heavy books, but most of the books we read are in paperback. They're portable. And they offer other kinds of pleasures as well. One of them is you know exactly how long it is, in a sense. You can hold it and you can ruffle through it and see its extent. You can gauge your commitment of time to it. You can select a copy based on its edition, its editing, the print. If you have multiple editions of a classic work, you have choice among various physical formats. I think people who have a physical book in their hand connect with it in a way that is more difficult when the engagement is on screen, although I spend much more time reading on screen because I'm at a computer all day than I do with physical books. And I regret that, but that's part of the world in which we now live.
Do you think that the way that we understand a book changes based on the form it comes to us in? You know, you talked about reading on a computer screen, which is what most of us do all day long. Does that change the way that we understand what we're reading?
I think absolutely. The technologies of reading affect the cognitive processes. We receive information in different ways based on the way technologies reveal texts to us. The most significant distinction is between the scroll and the codex. The scroll unrolls its secrets sequentially. It's very, you can't skim in a scroll. You start at the beginning, and you go chicka, 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 chicka as you go through it, as you roll the scroll up, until you get to the end. But if you can't flip back and forth in a scroll, the codex is, in a sense, a flip book. It allows you to read forward, but you can go back and forth. You can find things and mark them and move quickly back and forth. And that in and of itself had a remarkable effect on the way people learned to read, learned anew to read with this extraordinary new technology developed in the Middle Ages. The computer combines these things. We have the scroll, and we have a vastly enhanced search capability in the digital media. But again, once you have these tools, the question then becomes, do you lose something else? With the codex, you may lose the sense of surprise that's there in the scroll. With the technology of digital searching, one has to ask, do we lose other kinds of things? I think one of the things we worry about, and this is something that Plato worries about, is whether we are using technologies that erode our memory and our commitment to a certain kind of capture of knowledge and information. There's a passage in the Phaedrus where Plato has Socrates discussing the problem, or sort of this myth of the king of Egypt and the story of discovery of writing, and there is a resistance to this because writing will erode the memory. I think I worry about this a bit in digital technologies because it's so easy to find things. I wonder whether I and everybody else who uses computers are not sort of strengthening our memory, our own memories within our bodies, relying instead on the digital memory within our computers, the electronic memory within our computers.
Well, that kind of hits on one of the big worries right now, which is that things like the internet, Google, the quick search like you're talking about, that it makes us shallow thinkers who have the attention span of a gnat. You know, are we going to be able to have the discipline to sit down and scroll through War and Peace on a computer or Kindle?
I think it's a very important question. People sometimes simplify this and say, well, it's a choice of depth or breadth. But I don't think any of us really wants to be forced to make a choice between depth and breadth. We don't live our lives saying, well, today I'll have a depth day and tomorrow a breadth day. We need both of these things all the time. And I think that's true for reading as well. We want to have both depth and breadth. And we also don't want to simplify the tremendously complicated engagements of reading as if they were describable merely along those two axes.
One of the first really big books that I read when I was growing up was Gone with the Wind, which, as you may know, is a pretty hefty book, and it depicts this time in our nation's history that is very, you know, vividly rendered in that book. It really makes you feel like you're there during the Civil War. And, you know, it's historical. So the idea of reading a historical text on new media, reading that book now, just the idea of reading Gone with the Wind now, let's say scrolling through it on a computer screen, that seems so different. I almost can't imagine what that experience would be like. I almost feel like it wouldn't be like reading the same book. Have you ever done a side-by-side comparison like that?
It's so interesting. I'm teaching a course for undergraduates here at Cooper Union on the history of the book, and their first assignment is to take a text and read it in three separate media. I didn't want just two, I wanted three, because I didn't want merely to have the screen and the hard copy. And they are working on their projects now, coming up with all sorts of inventive ways, including one student is going to read a text in Braille, as well as using a digital a visual digital document and a hard copy. Another is going to use an audiobook as her third text. Another is having a text read to her over the phone in its original language. She's a bilingual student. And what I'm getting from them is this increased acuity with which they can understand how technology affects the process of reading. And these comparison papers are the ones I'm very much looking forward to reading this term.
So the jury's still out.
The issue of the long book, I think, is a particularly interesting one. I confess that I've tried to read a book on my phone, not on my iPhone, not on my smartphone, which I have to live on because that's what one does now. But I had a not quite so smartphone before my iPhone. And I said, well, I really need to read a book on it. So I read The Song of the Lark by Willa Cather on my phone. It's not a terribly long book, but it felt about as long as Gone with the Wind because it must have had 3,000 individual screens, quote, pages on my tiny phone. I think I read it on the Gutenberg free access text, but I could read it in the subway, and it was odd, and I felt I was performing a trick, but I was also happy that I had done it at least once. Am I eager to read another book on my phone? Not if I can hold a paperback in my hand, at least not at this point.
Yeah, phone is a little tiny screen. I've had friends show me the Kindle, and they've been very evangelistic about it. They love it, and they talk about how they can take it on the plane, and they can load it, and it doesn't have the glare that you get from computer screens. And yet I know a lot of authors really hate the idea of Kindle because it reduces their books to something almost imaginary.
There are fierce battles over Kindle. And the Nook and other reading devices, from frustration as to the current limitations of those tools, the adjustment of type, the adjustment of brightness, and so forth. But other people are passionate about it. The usual explanation I have from friends who love these devices is, if you're traveling and don't want to carry 10 books with you, you can have your Kindle. The problem for me, and I think that's great. I the older I get, the lighter the luggage I want to carry when I travel on a plane. But for me, I actually want to be able to put marks in my books. Because I teach, I often have several copies of the same book. I have a teaching copy which will have my incredibly precious tiny pencil marks, which I want to use to refer to. And then I want a clean copy in case I need to have a clean copy for a purpose, or lend a spare copy to a student who doesn't have a copy. It's very difficult to get away from having a copy with marks in it. That seems to me, for anyone who teaches or needs to refer to text, it's really difficult to get away from that.
At the end of your piece, you make the case that books are actually us. They're our ideas made kind of more digestible and more easy to take in. And that in that sense, maybe we don't have to worry about books because books are who we are.
You know, the other thing I say somewhere, I think it's in this piece, that books are sort of the smarter versions of us. At least I feel that way when I write something. If I read something I've written, and I've polished it as much as I could, I usually feel, well, I've said that as well as I could say it. And I certainly know other writers who feel, when they point to a book with pride, that having spent several years working on it, particularly for scholarly or nonfiction books, this is the best version of themselves on that subject. And I think that is something we need to sort of say out loud to ourselves, because it helps to provide a richer understanding of what it is we get pleasure from in these books. I think they are us. I think each book is a life. This certainly seems to be true for the novel, when the novel emerges in the 18th century. But the book is like something else as well, and I think, For me, I came across So I came to this realization a few years ago that a book is like a photograph as well. It's only possible because there's one person who's there at one place and at one time, that no book could be written by anyone other than the author. One might say, well, that can't be true for a math textbook, but I think it's even true for a math textbook. Hmm. There's one shaping intelligence that has taken that subject and turned it into a written text to be used by other people. And I think in the digital age, we are so concerned with questions of storage, of retrieval, of access, of dissemination, and these are very important issues in modern society, that we tend to overlook how important this question of the particularity of a single book is, that sense of shape and of limitation generates something which can then be used by the reader. It could be for pleasure, it could be for use, but those are not incidental products. Those happen because of the particular engagement of a particular individual within limitations. And for me, those limitations are really important. You mentioned Gone with the Wind. I was thinking of a book like Richardson's Clarissa, which is about 1,800 pages as a novel. It's the longest. I remember reading it thinking, oh, I'll never get through it. And when I finished it, I thought, you know, I look forward to another opportunity in my life to spend the time with this very, very strange, immensely long book. There's something about the limitation of the book, that's the way that it ends, the fact that it ends, that really gives the book its particular value in culture.
Our guest this morning is William Germano. He's the author of the piece we're talking about this morning. It's called What Are Books Good For? And it ran in the September 26th issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education. And we welcome your phone calls this morning. What do you think makes a book? Can you imagine reading your favorite book on, let's say, the Kindle or scrolling down on a computer screen? Do you think the experience would be the same? And maybe you have read your favorite book on all kinds of different media. Let us know what you think. Our number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you this Friday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking this morning with William Germano. He wrote a piece called What Are Books Good For?, which ran recently in the Chronicle of Higher Education. William Germano teaches English at Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art. And we take our first phone call now. We've got George joining us from Shawano. Hi, George.
Hello. I have two parts to my thing. Like, one, I'm a Kindle user.
Mm-hmm.
I have one. I enjoy it a lot, actually. I have to admit, for the first time with e-books, like with the ink screen, I feel like I'm actually reading a book. The big difference from the previous screens, and actually to counter what was said before, you can actually like write notes in them, leave marks. It all has that built in. So it does feel like a book experience for the first time, but at the same time, I also have a concern,
uh-huh.
And that everyone else who I deal with e-books seems to say the same thing. We don't want to pay as much for these books because
right.
We don't feel like we have anything physical, and I have a concern that that's devaluing books.
Right, and that's the big argument. A lot of authors are up in arms about that because it makes their books so much more easily sold and worth a lot less, it seems like. What about the value of art, William Germano?
I think this is one of the key questions, and it's always interesting to hear from people who are using the new technologies and thinking about improvements and what they like and what they don't like, because that's how the industry is going to advance. But the overarching question at the moment, I think, or one of them, for the publishing industry is to determine what exactly how exactly the texts that publishers control can be brought to the electronic market to an audience that's increasingly expecting things to be very inexpensive or indeed for free. And I think this is partly the this is partly the Wikipedia effect, that we are we're living at a time where we see the collectivization of knowledge and the open access to texts as a given. It's becoming less and less a curiosity and more something we take for granted. Before I was a professor and dean at the Cooper Union, I was a publisher. I was a scholarly publisher for almost 30 years. So I come to this, I come to these questions with the with a sense that it's very, very difficult for the publisher as well as for the author. Authors need to have their work carefully prepared by publishers and then rigorously disseminated and protected so that authors themselves can enjoy financial recompense from whatever means their work will reach their audiences. Audiences, on the other hand, want books increasingly for little or for free. And I think the issue of how to price and how to find the right level for financial investment is one that no publisher has solved yet. And it's clearly the elephant in the room. It's not even the elephant, maybe the whole herd of elephants in the room right now.
Yeah, because you think about an iPhone and you buy a $2 app or something, or a song for $1, it seems like a book should maybe be $4. And then you go to buy the hard copy of the book, the physical copy, and it's $15 paperback, it's $22 hardcover, and there's a huge divide there.
It's true. And if one reads some of my friends would say, the very nerdy books that I'd like to read in their digital form, the electronic forms might be considerably more expensive than that because it's a very, very small market. All these pricing strategies are, of course, based on the expectation of markets of a certain size. But I think those are the real questions. I don't have an answer as to how that pricing strategy is going to resolve itself.
Well, thanks to George. And on to Arlene in Two Rivers. Hi, Arlene.
Hi, I just have a comment. I'm 30 years old, and I just bought a Nook. I absolutely love it. It's very convenient. I travel a lot. I hate it with vengeance. I feel like I can't, you know, just put it anywhere. I'm afraid of breaking it. I'm very much divided even now I'm even thinking about returning it because I don't think I can in my daily lives, just leave it in the car and forget about it. And, you know, I know that nothing's going to happen to it, and I can just pick it up the next day. It's very much, much more emotional turmoil for me because I don't know to what extent I can mistreat it, if that makes sense at all.
Right. There's a whole different level of commitment to something like that. Right, Bill Germano?
I think this is right. I also think that it's true for all of our new expensive toys, including small laptops. We don't so much purchase these things as adopt them and take on almost parental responsibilities. We worry about their care, their feeding, where they are, whether they're in the sunlight. And of course, when one has spent a lot of money for one of these devices, whatever it may be, one is concerned about theft or damage. It's true that the Nook or the Kindle saves an enormous amount of weight compared to the books they can hold. But every individual user decides for herself or himself what the trade-off is going to be. I tend not to carry more than one or two books at a time with me, partly because of the weight, but also so that it will force me to focus on one or two books rather than having a half a dozen in my bag. That doesn't work for me, but it might work for someone else.
Right. And talking about the portability and the way you have to take care of it, I mean, you can't imagine tossing your Nook in the sand on the beach while you went in to take a dip.
Yes, I've always been a very bad reader at the beach. I'm not quite sure how people manage to do this. I suppose you can do it if you're reading something wonderfully popular that you may have picked up for free and will leave in the hotel lobby on the way out. But I tend to read either classic fiction or works of scholarship, and I need to keep up on my field, so they don't tend to be very beachy books.
It's not exactly beach reading. Don't you think maybe sometimes we're being so romantic about the book, though? I mean, whenever any sort of institutional object goes away or seems threatened, everyone crawls out of the woodwork and beats their chest about it. But in a way, this is just sort of the way of technology. It's the way it moves. And maybe we need to just get out of the way for it and embrace it. And there are certainly environmental positives to e-readers, too, to think about.
I think that's right. And I also think that it's very, very easy to create polarization in these discussions. Whether those of us who work with books, physical books, and I do a lot, whether we like it or not, our library space is challenged. We don't have enough library space to accommodate all the books that are being produced. And librarians and archivists are dealing with this all the time. Do we indeed scan things and dispose of hard copy? Do we save digital files? How safe are those? How permanent are those digital files? The argument is that it's not merely a matter of romanticism, but that digital platforms change, files are easily corrupted, the life of a CD is not as long as it might have once been believed to be. How safe actually would it be if we took a history of, I don't know, history of Poland in the 18th century and we digitized the text and then we let the hard copy go? How long will that text survive if it's only available in digital format? And I think those are real questions, but at the same time, we have to somehow address this issue of the physical space and weight and, indeed, the expense of storing, retrieving, and making accessible physical books.
Another call here. We've got Michelle joining us from Marshfield. Hi, Michelle.
Hello. I'm calling about that very issue, the permanency of books. I remember as a kid reading a short story, science fiction, I believe Asimov maybe wrote it, called The Fun They Had, about two children discovering a book in their attic of their great-grandfather, and their amazement at how you could turn the page and see that text and then turn it and it would still be there, unlike the computers they were used to working with. Now, that being said, we have the whole idea of banning and destroying books for content, Fahrenheit 451, for example. I think that's the big thing that I find a little distressing, because as a kid, I can remember going into the attic and stumbling across my mother's old copies of Little Women and Little Men. And will children have those wonderful experiences with the text book, the actual solid object? That permanency mm-hmm. and communication across time you may not have in the digital situation. And the writing in the margins, the marginalia, if you want to call it something, mm-hmm. Is something that I find fascinating, to see the words that my uncle wrote about a book that he had read when he was a boy in the margins, and to be able to leave those messages for people sometime in the future.
Right.
So that's my comment.
All right. Thanks a lot, Michelle.
Stay off the air.
All right. Thank you so much. Bill Germano?
Thanks for that. There are a couple of things. That's a wonderful comment. I was thinking, as you were speaking, about the way we use the book as a metaphor. You mentioned being able to turn the page, the story in which the page is turned, and the wonder of turning back and finding it. But we talk about that in our lives. We say, I'm going to turn a new page, or start a new page in my life, or in someone's life. We've used the book, the codex in particular, as a way of sort of creating a symbolic language for describing how we live in the world. The marginalia, I think, is one of the undervalued things. You know, we've always written in books. Family Bibles were the place where the only book in the home and the only thing that would be written in as a book, in which you would put birth dates and death dates and so on. These are precious things for families who have them. But there's also the serendipitous discovery of an old book. You can look at a book, you may find a book in a rare book collection or even just in a used bookstore that could be from the 19th century, and discover in the pages or on the inside of the covers the handwriting of a girl who was learning to write and practicing her name over and over and over again, maybe perhaps with the date, the place, maybe with a little line of poetry or a moral of some kind. There's something not only very touching about this, but there's almost a kind of an electric shock of feeling this is not merely an old book, but a real person held this book, and for a moment that person is recalled to you and in your presence. I hold on to those books with writing in them. I think the writing in the book is sometimes, for some people, even more important than the printed text on the pages itself.
Well, thank you so much for that call. And we move to Irv in Arborvita. Hi, Irv.
Well, I'm glad you've moved to children. I'm a grandfather, and we have 7 grandchildren living in our community. And they're with us a great deal, and they range in age from 1.5 to 12. And with a 12-year, I've been reading books that she reads, so we read together and we talk with each other. The littler children, we introduce to books when they're in our home. And some of the books are old books we had for our 3 sons. Andrew Henry's Meadow is just a delightful fantasy book. But the relationship between me and my grandchildren comes as a result of our sharing in the book, and the children's books, which are kinetic in many ways. You have a tab you can pull out, a lever you can pull down. You open the book and out pops an animal, which is three-dimensional. If that ever stops, I'll be incredibly sad, not only because we will have lost that wonderful fantasy and imagination stimulant, but the relationship that comes and the recovery of memory about having read the same book to my children, now my grandchildren, and maybe my great-grandchildren at some point in the future.
Thanks for bringing that up, Irv. That's a great point about how kids' books really become something more than the content of them. They become this experience, this sensory experience, and they give something for the child and the parent, the grandparent, to cuddle around, make it a spot, almost a destination.
It's also, I think, it's a wonderful demonstration of how books are a certain kind of glue that can provide connections between people that they may not even understand. The child will not understand the glueiness, as it were, of that at the beginning, but when your grandchildren are older, they will remember this. They will not forget that you spent time with them. And there's a very, very particular and, I think, powerful sense memory related to the recollection of having books read to one. One can often, you speak to people and adults will say, yes, I remember my grandmother, my grandfather, my parents reading to me. I remember the copy. I chewed the corner of the copy. I spilled my food on it. I scribbled on it with crayons because I didn't know how to write. And yet that dog-eared, damaged book turns out to be one of the most precious connections to people who may not be with them anymore.
Well, thanks so much for bringing that up, Irv. And we have an email from Larry in Madison who writes, does your guest think this transition away from paper books to digital books is one of the biggest changes to happen in reading? Or is this on par with going from an oral to a written tradition?
Wow. I think it is one of the biggest changes. The oral tradition to the written tradition, of course, is the beginning of it all. Once people find a way of, once writing comes into the human repertory, we have an extraordinary new capacity to change how we think about language, history, meaning, and so forth. But I do think that the digital is as important, and this tends to be the way people who work on book history think, is that the digital is as important as the introduction of movable type into European culture in the 15th century.
Mm. Well, an email from David in Rice Lake saying, you can't pass along an ebook you've read to a friend.
This is an interesting question. As someone has said to me that e-reading is selfish in a way. That you read the material online and you can't actually do anything with it further. Now, it may be possible, and I don't know because I haven't done this, to mark up your to read your book, to read it, to put your marks in it, and find a way of then passing that along with its marks. I haven't tried that myself, but I do know that lending books is in its way a very gratifying thing for the lender. sometimes I'm happy to lend books and hope they don't come back because I have too many books. And if I can get someone to, as it were, adopt one of my books, I feel I've given it a new home. It's a bit like a pet. Back to my adoption. I think it's back to my adoption of technologies metaphor.
Do you worry at all that if we turn to these e-books, it's going to kill our appetite for reading? It might turn it into something kind of trivial, whereas it used to be sometimes an investment. There was money, there was time, there was the weight of the thing. Do you think this could kill reading?
Well, I don't think it can kill it, but I think that kind of damaging effect is already present. I'm shocked to discover, as one reads in the newspapers or in blogs or in listens to conversations, in which people say, well, they don't have any time for reading anymore. And it's puzzling to hear people say that. I suppose this has always been a problem, of course. The Old Testament tells us of the making of books, there is no end, and there have been wonderful studies done in the last 10 years or so on the surfeit of information. Anne Blair at Harvard has a book coming out from Yale that I'm very keen to see, in which she talks about the moment when there is too much information. And that's in the early modern period. It's not right now. I think we've always had information glut. But the modern world offers so many distractions that it really takes a certain kind of discipline to commit oneself to reading. And I think that's a discipline that has to be taught. I don't think it's an innate skill that we have. We've got to work, like the gentleman is reading to his grandchildren, to give people a sense that there is an experience and a payoff that's worth the time that it takes, because it does take time. You can't speed read a complex novel. You've got to spend time and let it sort of saturate you. And that experience is precisely why you want to spend time with that work.
We're talking this morning with Bill Germano. He is a dean and professor at Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art. And he wrote the article, What Are Books Good For?, which ran in the Chronicle of Higher Education recently. And we welcome your phone calls this morning. What do you think about the transition happening in the reading world? Are you ready to make the transition to e-books, or do you think you're going to miss having something heavy in your hand, something made of paper? Our number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert here with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this morning is Bill Germano. He's the author of the piece, What Are Books Good For? We head back to phones now. We've got a call here from Maggie in Iola. Hi, Maggie.
Hi there. I'd like to just have a footnote on... Hello.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Yes, that The Time They Had was indeed by Isaac Asimov. It's his most reprinted story.
What is it called?
The Time They Had.
The Time They Had, okay.
And it's the most reprinted story, not so much because they were handling books, but because it was talking about the excitement of children being together in a school versus sitting at a home computer to learn. And, of course, school books all over the country have reprinted it in an argument for their own existence. I think we're talking about the consumption of words. So, to me, each device has a purpose. I have a Kindle for when I travel. It has the complete Mark Twain and 33 P.G. Woodhouse novels, and they're all in this lightweight thing I can carry. I could never carry those with me. I listen to audiobooks when I drive in a car or when I'm doing housework. I listen to your show when I'm at home doing housework. And, again, it's the consumption of words. I listen to NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour once a week to tell me about pop culture. I listen to books I already know to lull myself to sleep, and each method of consumption is different, but I live surrounded by words. I'm an editor. I have thousands of books, and each one I use for a different purpose.
That's a really interesting point. So a device and a method for every style. What do you think, Phil Germano?
Well, I think that having a Kindle with 33, P.G. Woodhouse, and the complete Mark Twain sounds like dessert. It sounds wonderful. I think it's certainly possible to discriminate the kinds of reading one has, and deploying it, or accessing it rather, through various various media and in various places. And in a sense, what I think it's Maggie is suggesting here is that she has figured out a system of organization of knowledge that works for her. And in an odd sort of way, the problem of the personal library is that problem in only one medium. Too many books, how do you organize them? Anybody who has more than 1,000 books in their home or their office worries about, what do I do? Is it by author? Is it by title? Is it by size? Is it by discipline? Is it by something else? And I think that discriminating across a variety of media access means is a very contemporary and very smart way of thinking about where I want to get access to the various things and kinds of things that I want to read.
That's definitely a less threatening way to think about it. I know that we live in a society right now, the kind of subway mentality where you can pick and choose exactly what you want. And this enables us to personalize our reading in a way that we couldn't before.
We can. And one of the things that has happened as a result of that, and again, because I'm at a college, but I think this is true for a lot of people, even those who are not directly involved in college teaching, is seeing the collected volume, which is a snippet of this and a snippet of that. Course readers, for example, in colleges would typically have selections from a variety of things, anthologies or gatherings of excerpts. And I think that's fine, and it's necessary for teaching. I do worry, however, that can become part of a larger sense that it's okay not to read a whole book. All you need to, show me the good parts of Anna Karenina, but don't ask me to read the whole thing. Which, actually, there can't be a good part of Anna Karenina, because it only exists as a whole thing. And I think that sense is, again, something that needs to be taught, rather than merely assuming that people who like reading will understand that they need to make a commitment to all of some work we think is wonderful or great or pleasurable.
Of course, when I'm reading a book, especially if it's something really plot-driven that's really long, maybe thinking of a John Grisham book, I don't actually sometimes read whole paragraphs. I'll kind of get the gist and I want to just get to the next plot point. So people don't necessarily read that purely either.
There are lots of ways of reading, and that's important. I think there are kinds of quick skimming across things. There are ways in which you dive down deep and then move along quickly. If you're reading a textbook, if you're reading a cookbook, if you're reading a car repair manual, you don't have to read the whole manual to fix the brake. You want to get to the part about the brake. And there are various ways of reading, and I think that is something for which more, as it were, visible conversation will help, because it will allow people to understand that it's okay not to read every word for certain kinds of things. And John Grisham may invite that kind of reading. I live in New York and I'm on the subway and I'm seeing people reading John Grisham all the time. And I think that there's a lot of people who read quite that way. On the other hand, I would hope that people will read Flaubert and read every word of Flaubert, or every word of Nabokov. And although one could skim P.G. Woodhouse, it would be, seems to me, such a shame, because the pleasure is, even in something as light and as delicious as his comedy, you want to read every word. You don't want to miss it. You want to slow the text down so that you can kind of be in it.
Right. Another call here, Peter joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Peter.
Yes, good morning, Professor Germano. I pretty well would agree with you and the callers this morning. I am newly retired only last year, and now past 73 years, and finally have the wonderful time to go over my own books, as well as now auditing courses at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, UWM. history and politics. But so I'm also attaining new new books. I've taken the liberty of going and looking at some of these electronic readers, and in here at the Apple Store too, that the Apple the iPad, and interesting technology. Yeah, I suppose there's a place for it, but as I look at it, I think I'm rather underwhelmed because the, I guess for those who are, is that the term sensualists? I guess I'm a sensualist. Love, you're just holding in the wonderful feel of a book. But let's go two aspects that were not stressed yet this morning that I think are important, certainly to me, but maybe probably to the others. To be able to get a brand new book, that massive gray area, and say, well, let's see, how to break that down into components, the organization of the book, whether it's scientific or fiction or whatever, to understand the layout, where the author is coming from, the index or the table of contents, and to be able to flip back and forth easily. And while one is reading it and studying it, if not the whole book, but certainly parts of it. And also, how about the sheer joy of making lots of notations with highlighting and pen and pencil in the book itself to make it look like so it's really being read, that one cannot do on an electronic reader, other than the Apple people said, well, look, you can highlight it, which is true. You do all these marvelous things, but I sure can't do what I do when I read, and I really read. How do you like that?
I think that the pleasures of writing in a physical book are so tactile. They're really of the body. They're somatic pleasures. Sometimes I think, you know, it's like giving a book a hug or a slap if you want to disagree with the author. But you also you're able to record your response. It's your response of the moment, and it's you thinking at that moment about what happened on that page. I'm sure we've all had the experience of going back to a book we wrote in years ago. Sometimes we'll not understand our own comments in the margin. Sometimes we'll say, boy, I got that right, or I don't feel that way anymore. And I think that those sort of recorded recollections of one's readings are tiny pieces of one's own biography. That is, one's library is a kind of CV, if you would. It's sort of the course of one's life, the books one owns. And the markings in one's books are a bit of a memoir in a certain sense. I think that my teenage son wants to read everything on a computer, but the other day he asked me to send some copies of his, to my great surprise, he said, would you please send my Nietzsche books to college? And I thought, gee, that's wonderful. I better pack them up, put them in a package, and send them off to him. It's very, very hard, I think, to not see some of these divisions as generational. My students will read books because they are required to, and I hope from that will also develop or continue the habits of reading physical books. But they are much, much more adept than I in terms of technologies. The students here are very smart, and they are also, they've grown up in the digital environment. They know more about how these things can work in terms of reading than I am likely to learn, certainly not at the speed they can.
Thank you for that call, Peter. And an interesting email from Amy in Madison, who writes that one thing I worry about with e-readers and really any kind of online reading rather than going to the store or library is that you miss the experience of seeing what's next to, above, and below the book you think you wanted. I can't tell you how many wonderful things I've found by wandering and just looking, and I'm not sure the digital world allows for this.
I think that's such an important observation, and it relates to the decline of bookstores. Yes, online bookselling, Barnes & Noble and Amazon, have become part of many of the lives for many of us. I know I buy lots of books online, but I know more or less what I want. And it's not quite the same having the online bookseller say, if you like this, you would like that, or on the basis of your preferences, we want to recommend X. Bookstores give us access to the things we think we're looking for and the tremendous serendipity of discovering things we didn't know about or had never heard of, indeed, the book next to something. I this is sort of a private plea, a public plea on Wisconsin Public Radio to support bookstores so that we can continue to have that serendipitous access to material. It's a bit like open stack libraries versus closed stack libraries. If you go to the closed stack library, you have to know you want a copy of X and fill out the form and turn it in or do it digitally. But an open stack library is a kind of magic place. You can go in and browse and discover things you didn't know you needed and then fall in love with a whole set of books.
Oh, William Germano, thank you so much. It's a great note to leave it on. We appreciate your time this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
William Germano, our guest this morning. He's the author of the piece, What Are Books Good For?, which ran in the September 26th issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's also a dean and professor at Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art. Thank you to Rhonda Fanning for technical direction this morning, and also to Erica Janik for on-air production and for producing this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.